Well, good morning. I'm David Barsamyan. I do alternative radio. I'm based in Boulder, Colorado. It's a weekly one-hour public affairs program that features dissonant voices that are usually not heard, actually rarely heard in corporate-controlled U.S. media. It's an independent program. I've been doing it since 1986. I've been doing radio since 1978. I don't have any formal training in what I do. I'm entirely self-taught. I tell you that not to boast about how brilliant I am, but this isn't rocket science or some, you know, organic chemistry that you need special training for, or brain surgery. It's just using a lot of common sense, being skeptical, having mastery over a disparate amount of information and being able to apply that in terms of interviews and producing radio programs. The project is entirely self-sustained. It has no corporate support, government support. Listeners just like you hear a program with Naomi Klein and call up the 800 number or email me and buy the tape, and that's the sole source of income. So that independence has a tremendous advantage. I can do pretty much whatever I want. I don't have to look over my shoulder and worry about Archer Daniels Midland and what they might think about a program on biotechnology, or if ExxonMobil is concerned about coverage of, you know, what they're doing in West Africa in terms of drilling offshore or whatever. So independence is a tremendous asset. It's also a liability in terms of being able to project what I'm doing. People don't know about alternative radio, like they don't know about Z Magazine. It's, you know, it's almost like Samizdat in the United States. You know, it's word of mouth. You know, we don't have full page ads in the New York Times. Time doesn't put Mike Albert on the cover, on its cover. NPR doesn't interview Noam Chomsky. You know, we're kind of below the radar screen of the corporate control media. You know, again, so advantages and disadvantages. One of the most important things in doing an interview is knowing who your guest is and how they pronounce their name. I was interviewed on TV in Denver a couple of Wednesdays ago on I was on a panel on the liberal media. That was what it was called, the myth of the liberal media. And the host of this show, he's been doing this for like 15, 20 years. He's well established. He never checked on the pronunciation of my name, nor did his producer. And, you know, he called me Bar Salmon. And that's kind of inexcusable on several levels. One is I was there an hour before. I had spoken to his producer several times, you know, in the preceding weeks, and they just could have checked that how you ID yourself, you know, director of alternative radio, author of da-da-da, and how do you pronounce your name? It's very embarrassing, if you imagine, to be doing a live interview and having to be corrected on the air. You know, it's not Vilka, it's Vilka. Sorry. Oh. I didn't check. So knowing who your guest is and their ID and being very clear about that was pretty dramatic. That this guy didn't take the time, and he's got a full time producer, you know, to check. And that was it was a kind of interesting show because we were trying to deconstruct this myth of the liberal media, a notion that is so deep in the aquifer of American consciousness. That, you know, it requires, you know, almost like a Dracula-like test, you know, to drive a knife through the heart of this shibboleth, which is repeated constantly in the media. In fact, that might lead to a very good interview. You know, how does a myth get established? You know, what is the evidence? Let's say you were a conservative talk show host, and I was doing an interview, or a conservative ideologue, you know, like Liz here from Madison, which is a very, you know, right-wing conservative town in the, you know, the Midwest. They just drink beer. Well, let's see. So, none of those things. So, okay, Liz, you're this conservative ideologue. You teach media studies at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. You've written many books on the topic of the liberal media. Could you give us some examples of the liberal media? You know, what as a concrete in a concrete way?
Well, I mean, look at all the press they had about Clinton after Bush was in office. I mean, the press was just enamored with Clinton. Right.
But wasn't most of that criticism was actually from a right wing perspective? You know, that Clinton was doing things in the moral area which offended the right wing. But his policies.
The liberal is a right wing perspective. Come on, the New York Times is the most liberal paper out there. That's supposed to be the voice, you know, whatever is fit to print.
Well, do you see that? Do you see that reflected in its editorial policy?
Yeah.
Could you give some examples?
Well, they.
This is where you catch people. You see, because then I'm not trying to catch her. I mean, we're playing a little game here. But whenever you have some rhetorical position, you know, like all brunettes are happy, or people who wear glasses are cool. Okay, so here's your sentence, right? People who wear glasses are cool. What's the evidence for that? What documentation do you have to fortify your assertion that people who wear glasses are cool? You know, you've got to be able to make it very concrete. It puts people on the spot in a very practical way. And it helps flesh out the topic. Feel free to interject and, you know, ask questions. Don't be passive here. We've got, you know, a short amount of time. So use me.
I just want to say, sometimes we were doing election night coverage, and someone was running for office against Tammy Baldwin, who's an out lesbian in Congress, and one of his campaign ploys was to, it was a really, really awful ad, and that was anti-Semitic and homophobic, and so there had been a movement to call him on it, and so it was election night, we had him on the air, and I was like, well, how are you going to take, what's your response to these charges from these community groups about, you know, this issue? And he was like, oh, well, you know, my daughter lives in West Hollywood, and she's half Jewish. But it's important to say, well, that doesn't answer the question. And I think that's what happens a lot, that people don't answer the question. I think it's very important to say, well, that doesn't answer the question, and to throw it back at them. And he was stumped.
Being ready with a follow-up, you know, being ready to improvise is an important part of any interview. And don't forget, you are the director of this art form. And this is an art form. You just don't, it's not a conversation. It's not, you know, I meet you at the, Swope's dining hall and we're having a little chat while we're waiting to get our, you know, dinner. That's a little, you know, informal chat. But when we're doing an interview, whether it's on video or for print or for radio, you have a certain amount of time to create a bouquet, to create a floral wreath, if you will, of various colors and textures. What are you going to do as the florist, because that's your role, to create a bouquet that is most attractive and informative and will take your listeners or your viewers or your readers from point A to, say, point D? I mean, I'm not going to be ambitious and say it's like from A to Z or A, you know, A to Z. But what is your direction? An interview should have a trajectory. It should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And if you could see it also like a pyramid, like this. Yeah.
I was wondering, to what extent do you give the person you're interviewing an idea of what sorts of questions you're going to ask beforehand? Or do you do that at all?
I just did an interview with Amartya Sen of India. He's a Nobel Prize winner in economics. He wanted to see all my questions in advance, and I just declined. I said, I don't do that. I don't do it for anyone. I didn't do it for Arundhati Roy. I don't do it for Angela Davis or Noam Chomsky. You know, it takes away the spontaneity and the healthy panic, as Avi Lewis of Counterspin says, of a live interview. I think that's very healthy. You know, if the person is well informed and has got something to say, they'll be able to respond.
Yes, but maybe the people that you are interviewing, they may have some knowledge that they want you to ask them about, because it's important for them, and you want to interview them because you know that they have certain things that could be helpful. is it important also to ask them, are there things you want me to ask you?
I would ask that, on a ad hoc basis, depending on the person. If it's in an area I don't know a lot about, like science, then I'm much more dependent on the skills of the person I'm interviewing rather than on my own knowledge. You know, if it's about globalization or the media or topics that I have some command over, I can generate a lot of questions. But let's say it's, in a couple of weeks I'm going to be interviewing Vandana Shiva in Santa Fe. She's from India. She's a big environmentalist. I don't know if you're familiar with her. I've published interviews with her in The Progressive as well as Z Magazine, and have done a number of radio programs with her. There was a very critical article about her in the current New York Review of Books, which essentially says she doesn't know what she's talking about when it comes to biotechnology. And so I want to see if she knows about this critique of hers. And I want to draw out, well, how do you respond to Jane Allison's contention that you exaggerate the dangers of biotechnology and GMO foods? So that would be, one example. But when I'm talking about, with Shiva, because she's a scientist, she's a biophysicist, that's not like one of my strong points. You have to know, it's not weakness to say you don't know a lot about a certain topic. In fact, it's a strength because you're not pretending. So there, I'm trying to find out, what this person knows and how to get it out. And with Shiva, I'm already starting the pre-interview in my brain, and I write down little notes, let's say, during the day, and I'm thinking, this will be an interesting topic to talk about. I may ask her about Arundhati Roy and the movements against the dam, the big dam projects in India. Why Shiva, who's a big environmentalist in India, why she hasn't gotten involved in that movement? There may be a myriad of reasons, no time, overcommitted, overcommitment, things like that. But I would like to know what her opinion is of what Roy calls the grandest, most brilliant resistance movement since Mahatma Gandhi. Mm-hmm. Did Satyagraha in India in the 1930s and 40s. So I'm already thinking about Shiva in my mind, and that's coming up in a couple of weeks. I also wanted to show you the tools of the trade. A very simple microphone, the microphone that I recorded Ron Daniels with last night. It's a professional Electra Voice. It's shock mounted, which means that the microphone element inside here, in this frame here, is isolated. So if it's Bruce, right? If I'm interviewing Bruce here and going back and forth, well, what about this, Bruce? And how come you decide to wear red today as opposed to your green T-shirt? There's no mic noise. And those kinds of things are, when you're doing a radio or TV, the mic noise is very irritating. It's like clunk, clunk. Yeah. It becomes, even with digital editing, it becomes impossible to edit out. Because if you're speaking over the noise, it's different when you go like this and there's clunk. Okay, you can edit out the clunk. If it's not live, if it's live, it's going out, it's being broadcast. But the fact that it's shock mounted, it means it's isolated, so there'll be no mic noise. The listener or the viewer does not want to know about any of the technical things going on. They want to hear what Vilka has to say about Greek politics, or what that big demonstration was like when Madeleine Albright and Sandy Berger and William Cohen went to Ohio State University in this fantastic interview on CNN Live, where there was a huge uproar in the audience. Mm-hmm. That's what people
couldn't have finished.
They don't want to know that. We're having technical problems today. Tape jam. Those kinds of things. Yeah. Nothing like that. Also, to really make a guest, particularly someone who's a community activist who may not be very comfortable with the media. This may be, you know, she may be working at the battered women's center in town, so she's not like a trained media person. And then, you know, you're saying, well, let me see here. I'm not sure if I got this tape recorder working here. And,
can you say that again? I didn't get that.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, this is the first time I ever used this machine. Let me see if I can get it to work. So meanwhile, this person's thinking, like, you know, who is this turkey? I'm already a nervous wreck. I've never been on the radio before. This guy doesn't know what he's doing. So what you're doing is just like heightening tension to the bursting point. So one thing we need to all be, no matter where we're working in, be it metallurgy or carpentry or dentistry or radio or video, we need to be masters of our tech, bar none. We never want to get, as Avi Lewis of Canada says, caught with our microphones down. And so we need to have the technology serve us, and we need to be in absolute control of it a priori, not on the job training while you do. Oh, let me see. If I turn this up, is that light working? Do you think this will? Let me see if, you know, this is like disaster. So spending time, you know, with your technology and understanding it, feeling comfortable with it, and it's your toy. Because this is your vehicle. This is how you're going to convey, you know, whatever is going to come out, be it, you know, a series of radio interviews with Noam Chomsky that turns into a book, for example. Or an interview I did with Arundhati Roy in the back seat of a car driving from Amherst to Logan Airport in Boston, you know, in a very difficult situation with, you know, my notes here kind of, and then the roar of the car and the highway and trying to stay focused. You know, so having this technology working on your, you know, totally, and you're totally in control of it. This microphone's about $150. This Sony DAT, DAT means digital audio tape, which is the preferred medium now for professionals in the field to record on DAT or mini discs. It is not the preferred medium for consumers. There are no DAT players in cars. People don't walk into their kitchens and pop on their DAT machine to listen to the latest, you know, Amy Goodman Democracy Now! Tape. Cassettes are still very, very popular, and CDs as well. So DATs are being used for professional use, but have very, because of the expense.
How much is that?
Yeah. This machine is around $800.
Oh, yeah.
Right. The microphone's $150, $200. So there's 1,000 right there for hardware.
How do you spell that? DAT?
DAT, uppercase.
Is that a radio mic?
This is a broadcast quality microphone. That's shock mounted. One thing, and it also has a built-in windscreen. So a built-in windscreen has the advantage of when people are popping peas, and people in Pakistan are very poor. The peas are not
the
pea poppers and the sibilant hisses.
Yes.
The sisters, you know, the sisters in Saskatchewan who have, you know, this guy, sisters, that cuts that out. So shock mount, you may sometimes see broadcasters roll a sock over the thing. That's to cut down on the wind noise when you're out in the field. Like I used this for Ron Daniels last night. And that was a broadcast quality recording. This is an omnidirectional mic, which means the pattern is like this. So that even when Daniels sort of went, you know, a little bit here, which is on mic, and a little bit here, the whole range is picked up. It's good to have an omnidirectional microphone to do an interview, as opposed to the other type, which is called a cardioid. A cardioid, as it suggests, is a very narrow kind of wavelength. So if you're slightly off, if I'm interviewing...
you're going to hear this noise over here, right, instead of this noise.
He literally is dropping out. I mean, it sounds like he's back at 18 Millfield Street. You know, and I'm on mic, and I'm very clear and full range, you know, full broadband. And he's like, you know, this distant sound. That kind of you know, again, that really puts the listener off, and they're gone. Because of the way media are today, and because we're all time impaired, most people aren't going to wait for David to get his act together. Well, maybe the next question, you know, he'll have his tape recorder at the right level, and I'll just wait because I'm patient. No, they're gone. They're in their car, they're looking for the next thing. Hey, I don't need this. Let's see, maybe I can find some music. So again, you know, being a master of the tech is absolutely important.
And that mic is actually cordless?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
No, I didn't bring the connector.
Okay, so
it's not a cordless mic.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a connected mic. There's just a little, you know, cord between here and there. But so last night's program, I'm already anticipating that I will produce that. He spoke for about 70 minutes. My program's an hour. I have an intro and an outro, so I'll probably have to edit out about 15 or 18 minutes, which will be fairly easy. And that'll be a radio program, you know, something that you heard last night.
Who makes that mic?
This is made by ElectroVoice, and it's an industry standard mic. It's called an RE50. And you can get it from Full Compass in Madison or CCI in Olympia, Washington. They both have 800 numbers. I'm not a big fan of lapel mics, which are put, you know, like, attached to you. Okay, let's take this, for example. This just happened to me, right? Or a woman wearing a silk blouse with a V-neck. Okay, you put this, like, piece of metal here like this, so the mic is, like, down to here now. And, like, I'm really nervous, and I'm, you know, touching here, and all of that gets picked up. So this mic is quiet. Lapel mics have certain applications that are really good when people know exactly what they're doing. And, you know,
a little better for video than that. It hides up.
Yeah. This is not a great video, you know, prop. And lapel mics, when you've got people sitting back, like that, when I was interviewed, when the guy mispronounced my name, there were three other people. We were all sitting around a table. We all had lapel mics. Because you can't really be going around with microphones, you know, right on TV.
I've had people come back after doing a field recording and having an awful recording because they let the other person hold on to the mic. They would just pass it to them, and then the other person isn't used to speaking, so they're kind of all over the place. And then another thing about mini discs, you can get them for about $200 or under at places like Best Buy, stuff like that. You can find mini discs prices that become more reasonable.
Yeah, mini discs are much cheaper.
How much?
About $200. We've gotten some for $175.
The DAP?
No, mini discs.
Okay. Just digital audio.
Yes, right, the mini digital.
What's on the floor? What Maria has on the floor. That's
okay.
The mini disc.
Okay.
But with those, one thing to just mention, my first, I'm just getting used to this myself. My batteries ran out while I was recording something, and I lost everything on the disk because it's like a computer disk. It has to save the...
How much can you get on?
About 70. It's like a CD length.
Yeah.
But right now I'm recording mono on there, and you get twice as much.
Time,
okay.
So last night I had a 125-minute DAT. You know, 2 hours and 5 minutes. You know, I knew Daniels wasn't going to, you know, would not speak for more than, say, an hour and 15 minutes and then the Q&A. So I got, you know, virtually everything. And I used power. Should always use power. Have batteries as a backup, but not as a front up.
Right.
Batteries fail, and they're very unforgiving in analog as well as digital recording. It's not like, you know, you're getting a gradual fade and you've got you know, it just drops out. It's gone and you've got nothing. And that's a disaster. I mean, just imagine this. I mean, the situation last night, right? I'm recording Daniels and the DAC failed, you know, or I failed to put on the record level, you know, so I had the thing on, but the record level wasn't up. And so what are you going to do? Hey, Ron, could you come back tomorrow? And could we do it? You know, what are your options, realistically speaking? It's gone. In fact, he's literally gone.
Well, I noticed you checking it quite a bit last night.
Because he was really blowing into it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there was a lot of peaks and valleys. And I wanted to check the modulation. Another problem with DAT, as opposed to analog, is DAT is very unforgiving when it's getting too much sound. Mm. It cuts out. It's what the technical term in radio jargon is like. It doesn't have much headroom to absorb sound surges. whereas analog does have headroom and absorbs sound surges. So imagine your tape, any tape, this is analog tape, right? Naomi Klein, no logo. Let's get to the actual tape.
Do you ever use like a compressor sort of thing?
No.
I mean, I know they have.
I don't like the artificiality of a compressor. I want to get as close to the human voice as I can without that kind of technical intervention. It has some application. She's much more in music than in voice. So here's, you know, your typical analog tape. It has a certain amount of capacity. Imagine it's like this cup, right? So what kind of signal do you want to get to your tape? Is there any tape, DAT or this kind, or to the, let's say you're burning a CD. You know, if you're imagining it, then let's say this is an 8-ounce glass, if we can use the horrible American system, and you know you're just getting 1 ounce of liquid in here. So you're like, you're 7 ounces short. You're not really utilizing this cup. You're not getting a real good, you know, your thirst is not getting slaked. Then you're moving up, you know, halfway. Okay, so you got half the capacity of the tape is now being utilized. And then you're up further, and now you're over the top. Now you're getting very, very thirsty, and you're sending a signal into the glass that's spilling over onto the floor and you know, becoming a total mess. The tape has lost the capacity to absorb the signal, and you get distortion. In the case of DAT, it just cuts out. So I could be speaking, and you got... that's that. In analog, does anyone have an analog? Well, this is an analog. Let's say that we were using this as a tape recorder. You would get a huge surge in volume that would make the whole thing so blurry you couldn't make. There would be no resolution of sound because the tape has lost the ability to absorb. You've miscalculated the amount of liquid you had and versus the capacity of the glass. So with Daniel's last night, a couple of times he was going like right into the mic at very high volume. Mm-hmm. I had to like, you know, jump up and lower it a little bit because I wanted to avoid those kinds of peaks.
Do you have any way on there to monitor when the signal's blowing out?
It has their LED, readouts, and you want to keep it at a certain level. In the case of DAT, it's around 10 or plus 10 or plus 12 on this. You know, it can take some peaking. It can take some surges. It's natural. Like, I'm not speaking in a monotone. And when I just rose a few minutes ago, I was more animated and there was more volume in my voice. Simply because when you stand, you can generate more energy when you start using your hands. Which is when I'm recording speakers in the field, I always insist that they stand up because they can generate more energy and there's more action in the mic. Like the Daniels program, that recording last night, that will be a terrific recording, you know, not because I'm smart or anything, because he was moving around also. And that creates peaks and valleys in the sound stream. And that, for you as a listener, becomes very attractive. It's like a mosaic of sound. You know, it creates texture. It's not like one person speaking into the microphone in a monotone like this, which will very soon get you terribly bored and not captivated. But rather, I'm now talking to Bruce. Now I'm shifting over to Tani. Now I'm going over to...
Rick, sorry.
And, you know, moving around like this, creating action. And that action translates into audio texture. Now, when we're doing radio particularly, that's our weapon. That's our ace. That's our main card is audio texture. We don't have images. You know, we don't have, faces. We don't have props. We don't have background. We don't have anything. So that's our image. We're trying to create... you know, an audio picture, and so that kind of thing is very helpful when, you know, someone is giving a speech standing up. And Daniel's, you know, as I mentioned, is a drop dead speaker. I've done 3 or 4 programs with him. They, you know, always do very, very well. People are very interested in someone, even if they don't agree with what he's saying, that is able to use oratory in that fashion as an art, you know, as an art form, as a presentation. It's very, very attractive. Like Arundhati Roy also is a wonderful speaker. Naomi Klein of Canada, she did a book called No Logo, and I did a program around that, and I recorded her a couple of weeks ago at a public talk. Again, the same kind of thing. There was a lot of dynamics. There was this moving around, and this mic is very forgiving because it has a broad spectrum to get the sound, as opposed to those other microphones. As soon as you move over like this, it's like total dropout.